word or two here.
Full potential to
our level of accessibility. Want to take one and pass it on?
The summary of works is very appropriate as we move from a Western paradigm to a now we're ready to hear about a Chincha Beta Beta
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. So the text here in three chapters from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bengali language canonical biography of Chaitanya. So this is really not just Vaishnavism, but Gaudiya Vaishnavism, which centered around the figure of Chaitanya. Now, I passed out a piece of paper which has a couple of things on there because there's two contexts that are really different in discussing the appearance of the Lord in the material world and taking on of devotee nature. One difference is in fundamental principles or ontological categories, if you want to call them that. The other is the temporal framework of things. In Christianity, of course, there's only one unique time, which there is an incarnation of God. Notoriously, in Vaishnava traditions, all time, coming over and over again. I think this is because the idea of time is quite different. Time moves these massive cycles of ages. If you're not familiar with this, I've given a little summary of this in the one side of this page. Because it says in the very beginning, when discussing the appearance of Chaitanya, we have to refer this to the earlier appearance of Krishna. That is Krishna in Braj, in Vrindavan Krishna. And that Krishna, the son of Nanda Maharaj, descends only one time within each day of Brahma. A day of Brahma, Brahma is the Demiurg, who puts the universe together. Each day of Brahma is 1,000 yuga cycles. The yuga cycles is this circle of Satya, Treta, Dwarpa, Kali, the age of gold, the age of silver, the age of iron, the age of brass. We're in Kali Yuga right now, which is supposed to have begun in the year 3112 BC. Each of these cycles is 4.32 million years. They're long cycles by our terms. I've broken them down here. So within the day of one day of Brahma, the appearance of Braja Krishna is rare. Otherwise, in every yuga cycle, the Lord appears in order to do certain things. There's almost regularly scheduled incarnations, and one of them is called a Yuga Avatar who promulgates the Dharma, the practice for that age. So this happens no matter what, but in one day of Brahma, Vraja Krishna comes, and what he does is over the top, more than needs to be done for protecting the righteous. Krishna's mission statement is in the Bhagavad Gita. I come yuga after yuga, and whenever irreligion becomes great and religious principles decline, at that time I descend. I annihilate the miscreants, the evildoers, and I protect the devotees, and I reestablish the principles of Dharma. This the Lord has to do because religion comes from the Lord, And if he didn't keep descending periodically, it was just as though there were no state road repair people to come and fix the highways. Even though God establishes religion, because it's in the material world, it deteriorates it, and so he has to keep fixing it. And so that's what he does on a fairly regularly scheduled basis. But when he revealed himself as Krishna in Vrindavan, Raja Krishna, this was more than just that. And what's explained here in the beginning of this this chapter, when he comes, is that he is what he's doing more is disclosing what I could call the private life of God. Now, he appears like an ordinary human being. He's a coward boy. Is Ramachandra, other times, at least he's a teen. You know, he's got majesty and might and glory and so on. More appropriate to godhood. One of the Sanskrit names for king is Naradev, God among humans. You know? But this time, he's not the urban Krishna, it's the rural Krishna. Like a cowherd boy in a simple village. And the idea about now there's only one God, but this one God, because has different relations with different kinds of devotees in different ways, manifests in innumerable forms. So here I have to say that within the personality of Godhead, There is a multitude of personal forms. So the only other place I know where there's an idea similar to this is in Christianity, with the notion of Trinity. That there's a social life within divinity, where God has relationships with himself, to which the devotees are invited to take part in this social life of divinity. And so there are these in the category of God, we're going to use the term Vishnu Tattva. This is on the other side of this page. The Vishnu Tattva. Tattva means basic or fundamental principle. So there's the category of God, who is infinite, all powerful, the predominator. But because the one God expands himself into multiple forms for the purpose of sustaining different kinds of relationships with devotees. So each form that's Vishnu Tattva is a full power, but sometimes only some of this is manifest for some particular purpose or some aspect of it. So there's the majestic royal Narayan, the form of the Lord, where the majesty is predominant. When it comes to Krishna, it's the same Lord, but the majesty is suppressed, and the other side, the sweetness. What was it? Majesty and meekness? Jonathan Edwards? That in, it's a one of the Puritan, yeah, but he got it from somebody else. Jonathan Edwards, magic. So there's here it is, madhurya, sweetness. That God's majesty keeps the jivas at a distance because of awe and reverence, but God wants to enjoy close relationships, and so he conceals his majesty. So that now his devotees can be like parents or like friends of the same age or like conjugal lovers. This is the idea of Krishna. Now the idea is that the activities of the Lord in Krishna are eternal. They take place in the spiritual world, where the Lord is there in a spiritual form. It's analytically true in Vaishnava thinking, when you say, maybe Hindu thinking in general, to say that someone is a person is to say that that person is embodied, has a form, a spiritual form. Nirmatikan soma, that's not such a strange idea for Christians. And the spiritual form has been described. Each limb can perform the functions of all the other limbs. It's a completely unified form. So God is there in a spiritual form. His associates are in a spiritual form, and in those spiritual forms, they engage in exchanges of love. In a place, in a heavenly place, a transcendent place, where this is going on. When God descends, the whole thing comes down. He doesn't come by himself, but his associates, his entourage, the whole thing becomes manifest on earth for some time. The Vaishnava idea is that in one sense he never really enters the material energy the way we are, because we become controlled by the material energy. And if he's in the material energy, because he always remains a controller, it's not really material for him. From God's point of view, there's no difference between material and spiritual. That's our distinction. It's not really his distinction. So this is the idea of the Lord's descent. So there's this category of God, Vishnu Tattva, of different varieties of manifestations. Instead of saying humanity or man, we would have to say jiva tattva, the category of the infinitesimal soul, like a spark of the divine. At least according to Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, most Gaudiya positions, they say that the souls are spiritual, and so qualitatively the same as God, but they're tiny, small. Infinitesimal, God is infinitely great. So qualitatively the same, quantitatively different. On this view, we're already a little close, being something of the same substance, but still not, because of this minute nature, the souls can become covered by illusion or maya and forget their intrinsic nature. Because the intrinsic nature of the jiva is to serve God and to love God, that which we have forgotten it. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, in another chapter, Sanatana Goswami asks Chaitanya. He says, "I don't know who I am. I don't even know who I am. Who am I? What is my nature?" And so Chaitanya says that in answer to this, Jivera Swarupoi Krishna Nityadas. He's saying you are a jiva, and the swarup means the essential nature of the jiva is perpetually or eternally Krishna's servant, Krishna Nityadas. So every creature. I mean, in this conception, of course, the jivas are transmigrating through all species of life. The human life is, of course, the most significant, because the consciousness is more fully manifest. But all creatures are jivas. But all of them, all of us in the material world, are forgetfulness. We have forgotten who we are. The jivas are called tatasta. Tatasta means marginal or liminal shakti. They're one of the energies of God. They The Vaishnava position is that the Supreme Brahman or the Absolute Truth has energies or shaktis. This is significantly, this is Shankaracharya's position, denies that God has energies. That's really the crucial thing of the monistic idea. Because God is absolute means not relative, there's nothing else, and so there's only one thing, it's totally homogeneous, undifferentiated. But the Vaishnava position is that God is Savishesha, with particulars. Whereas as the impersonalist position in India is called Nirvishesha, without any differentiation, without any particulars. So this idea that the Absolute Truth has energies, these are Shakti Tattva, so that these energies are divided into three. One is called internal, which always reminds me of internal and external relations in philosophy. One is internal, one is external. Because in a way, God is really affected by the internal energy. The internal energy which produces this the kingdom of God, the spiritual, the transcendent world, whereas the external energy is this world. But both these energies also have personal forms, so that the internal energy is manifested. Energy is feminine. So Radharani is one form of the internal energy. Lakshmi Devi, and the Lord is together with them. There's Radha Krishna, Lakshmi Narayan, or Sita Ram, because the Lord actually consorts intimately with these energies. The Lord does not consort intimately with the external potency, but now here's where I use this. But when he does, he's called Lord Shiva. He takes on a different aspect. So this is just the basic background of what's going on. If I could give you this quick ride through an ontology of the Lord and his energy. So there's Vishnu Tattva and there's Jiva Tattva. So the Jivas are in the spiritual world, but some never fall down. And there are jivas in the material world. We're amphibious. We could be in either place. But our real, because we're spiritual, our real place and our constitutional position is to be in the spiritual world, engaging in loving service to God. God, the purpose of his descent to the world is basically to bring people back. It's a kind of reformatory. We come here, according to Gaudiya Vaishnava position, that the reason we come down is because we desire to become God ourselves. We desire our own God projects, and we don't want to be what we are. We deny our own reality, and so God provides us with a kind of an illusion. Which is what we see in this world. So this appearance of Krishna is something that happens occasionally, so that once in a day of Brahma, so that one can actually see that when God is seen in his very personal, intimate way, there is actually natural, spontaneous love for God. It doesn't depend upon thou shalt this, or the injunctions of the scriptures are not necessary, but there just is natural, spontaneous attraction. Because God is so lovable, you love him. And this is a confidential, this is kind of an esoteric side of God. Because if that were shown, if God appears in such an intimate way, almost as though he's on a level with us, everybody who's got animosities toward him would mock him, deride him, not appreciate him,
he has to put on the show of force to most of the fallen souls in this world. So this is why this is pure in majesty and splendor and power and might and so on, because people are so fallen. So now what happens, what this text is now explaining, is that that when Krishna comes and shows these pastimes, still there was something incomplete. And so that whenever Krishna comes, he comes in one age, the Dwarpa Yuga. At that time, the next age, Chaitanya comes. With the key of, with the purpose of making the Krishna, Vrindavan Krishna, accessible to people who otherwise would not be qualified.
I'll read a little passage. This is from another chapter. In the Adi Lila, chapter 7. The characteristics of Krishna are understood to be a storehouse, a prema bandara, like a warehouse of transcendental love. And that storehouse of love certainly came with Krishna when he was present. Although that storehouse of love came with Krishna when he was present, it was sealed. Because so few people actually had the qualification to access it. But when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came with his associates of the Pancha Tattva, they broke the seal and plundered the storehouse to taste transcendental love of Krishna. The more they tasted it, the more their thirst for it grew. Pancha Tattva, that's Lord Chaitanya and four main associates, themselves danced again and again, and thus made it easier to drink nectarian love of Godhead. They danced, cried, laughed, and chanted like madmen, and in this way they distributed love of Godhead. In distributing love of Godhead, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates did not consider who was a fit candidate and who was not, nor where such distribution should or should not take place. They made no conditions. Whenever they got the opportunity, the members of the Pancha Tattva distributed love of Godhead. Although the members of the Pancha Tattva plundered the storehouse of love of Godhead and ate and distributed its contents, there was no scarcity. For this wonderful storehouse is so complete that as soon as the love is distributed, the supply increases hundreds of times. Thus, the flood of love of Godhead swelled in all directions, and thus young men, old men, women and children were all immersed in that inundation. The Krishna consciousness movement will inundate the entire world and drown everyone, whether one be a gentleman, a rogue, or even lame, invalid, or blind, and so on. So it goes on like this. So this, that's the idea, that they very liberally made this accessible to everybody through the Yuga Dharma, which is Nam Sankirtan, especially the recitation or communal or a group recitation, chanting of the congregational chanting of the names of God. So here in page 2, he's depicting Chaitanya thinking, I shall personally inaugurate the religion of the age, Nam Sankirtan. I shall make the world dance in ecstasy, realizing the four mellows, the rasas of devotional service. I shall accept the role of a devotee, and I shall teach devotional service by practicing it myself. And then they depict Mahaprabhu quoting from the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavad Gita about how the Lord comes through to reestablish religion, and how the Lord himself has to set the example. Then Chaitanya says, and this is text 26, my plenary portions, that is to say my expansions, can establish the principles of religion for each age. No one but me, however, can bestow the kind of loving service performed by the residents of Braj. So therefore, the Lord appears in this way. And then here, Krishnadas Kaviraj is concerned to show that there are scriptural statements in support of claiming that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the incarnation for Kali Yuga. This is a familiar practice to everybody, I think. And so here he quotes from the Bhagavatam when Krishna's priest said that this boy Krishna has three other colors, white, red, and yellow. Chaitanya is the yellow avatar. And then he quotes other texts from the Vishnu Sahasranama, the thousand names of Vishnu found in the Mahabharata, where here again different names of the Lord, he shows that these apply to Chaitanya. And then especially in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's this text. In Kali Yuga, people worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead by the regulations of revealed scriptures. Can you now hear that from me? In the age of Kali, intelligent persons perform congregational chanting, a Sankirtan Yajna, to worship the incarnation of Godhead who constantly sings the name of Krishna. Although his complexion is not blackish, he's Krishna himself. He's accompanied by his associates, servants, weapons, and confidential companions. And then there's a whole analysis of this Sanskrit text in Bengali to show different readings of it and how they all apply to Chaitanya. So that's one of the... finally, we're getting down to text 81. He quotes Jiva Goswami in the Bhagavad Sandarbha, who glosses this text as saying, I take shelter of Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is outwardly of a fair complexion, but inwardly Krishna himself. In this age of Kali, he displays his expansions, his angas and upangas, by performing congregational chanting of the holy name of the Lord. So, like this. So here he summarizes, Srimad Bhagavatam, the Mahabharata, the Puranas, and other Vedic literature all give evidence to prove that Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the incarnation of Krishna. So this is important to give scriptural evidence for this. Then this particular chapter includes with a story. I mentioned this Panchatattva. You have that picture over there? This the word tattva again means fundamental principles. So Lord Chaitanya appeared with four principal associates, and together they are known as the Panchamis Five, the five tattvas. And they're depicted iconographically like this. There was a certain incident where everybody realized this is who they were. Here's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in the middle. Right? To his immediate right is Nityananda. Nityananda, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna, but taking on the role of a devotee, and especially Radharani. Nityananda is said to be Lord Balaram, Krishna's first expansion, also in the form of devotee as Nityananda. Further to his right is Advaita Acharya, who this text is talking about now, who is said to be an incarnation of Mahavishnu. When the material world is created, there's a series of avatars called the Purusha avatars, who gradually help are called avatars because they, from one the universes come out, the next one enters into the universes and so on. This is the first of those is Mahavishnu. So here's the Lord's expansions, and this is the Lord's Mahavishnu incarnation. This side is Vishnu Tattva. When we get to the other side, there's Gadadhar, who is said to be either an incarnation of Radharani or Radharani's emotions. So Vishnu is an incarnation of the Shakti Tattva, the spiritual potency. And this last is Srivas, who's said to be an incarnation of the sage Narada Muni, who's a jiva. So here in this you have the Lord, his expansion, his avatar, his internal energy, and the jiva. So the whole metaphysical array is here in these five. This is the term pancha tattva. This is the understanding of a revelation to the followers of Chaitanya, seen at one time. So the first to appear before everybody else was Advaita Acharya. He was actually a contemporary of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's father, or maybe a little older than him. He came first, and Advaita Acharya here is depicted on the seventh page as being very upset because people are so engrossed in material life. They've forgotten their devotional life. They're simply interested in, it was a university town, Navadvip. They were all engaged in logic and speculation and so on like that and so on. And therefore, he thought that the only way people could be saved if Krishna were to appear as an incarnation and teach the chanting of the holy names. And so he thinks of a text. The text, Sri Krishna, who is very affectionate toward his devotees, sells himself to a devotee who offers him merely a tulsi leaf and a palm full of water. With this text in mind, he then prayed ardently for the Lord to come, and it said this prayer is what induced him to come. So Dwaita Acharya is a kind of a precursor who makes him come. The point is drawn is that Krishna appears in all his innumerable eternal forms because of the desires of his pure devotees, who are distressed with the state of the world and beg him to appear. That's the third chapter, which is described as the external reasons for the Lord's appearance, to practice and teach and to show people how to learn how teach them or give them actually spontaneous devotional service for Krishna. Then in the next chapter, with this what's called the Lord's personal, his own confidential and private reasons for his appearance. He has reasons of his own. You could say, when you say this word confidential, you could say esoteric. No? It describes how lost my notes. Okay. So now he's going to tell us the internal reasons for the Lord's appearing. Is he says that. Here in the beginning is describing first of all the appearance of Krishna again. How he's Purna Bhagavan, the complete Godhead. All the other expansions all come together in him, and he appears in this way. And then wanting to propagate this rag marg, spontaneous loving service, the spontaneous of on the platform of spontaneous attraction. And it describes here, as Krishna, how he takes pleasure here in this. Mother sometimes binds me as her son. She nourishes and protects me, thinking me utterly helpless. He takes pleasure in this, having his devotees take care of him, rather than vice versa. My friends climb on my shoulders in pure friendship, saying, what kind of a big man are you? You and I are the same, equal. If my beloved consort reproaches me in a sulky mood that steals my mind from the reverent hymns of the Vedas. Taking these pure devotees with me, I shall descend and sport in various wonderful ways unknown by Kunta. I shall broadcast such pastimes by which even I am amazed. But Krishna has this capacity to astonish himself. The influence of yoga maya, this is the energy, the internal potency of Krishna by which he both conceals himself and reveals himself. In order to reveal some aspects of himself, he has to conceal others. His majesty is concealed and his sweetness is revealed. Will inspire the gopis with the sentiment that I am their paramour. I mean, the ontological goal is now overcome. Neither the gopis nor I shall notice this. See, I won't notice it either. It's going to happen by my yoga maya power, and I myself will forget who I am. For our minds will always be entranced by one another's beauty and qualities. So this is Krishna's. So this is also called a human-like form. Their platform that looked like human pastimes. But actually, the esoteric meaning of these are exchanges of devotional love, of ever increasing intensity. So then it is explained here that of all these feelings, the one that is in a sense the most intense is this madhurya rasa, this conjugal rasa. Whatever there is, in one sense they're all equal. Whatever satisfies, whatever the devotee is naturally naturally feeling to relate to God as a friend and as a paternal rasa or as a parent, that's really satisfying for the devotee and for the Lord. But if you look at them objectively in order of intensity, then there's a hierarchy where they become more and more intimate and more intense. And that's why this madhurya or conjugal lover conjugal rasa is considered the highest, and Krishna says he appreciates it the most. And the center of this conjugal love is between Krishna and Radha, the personification of his pleasure energy. So here's the verse that he's basing this text chapter on, one of them. The loving affairs of Sri Radha and Krishna are transcendental manifestation of the Lord's internal pleasure-giving potency. Although Radha and Krishna are one in their identity, they separate themselves eternally. Now these two transcendental identities have again united in the form of Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So here's a dialectic for you. There's one, and now they're manifest as two, and then as Chaitanya they become one again, but it's a different one than the first one. And we'll see what this is. Then he gives a whole long description of who Radharani is, and about the Radharani also has associates which are also her expansions. And they all serve Krishna in different ways. Vladini means the pleasure. So it just means pleasure. So it's the Vladini Shakti. The Lord said to have three internal potencies. One is Vladini, by which he feels bliss and gives bliss to others. Another is called Sandini, by which he maintains his own existence and the existence of everything else. And Sambit, by which he knows everything and causes others to know him. So just like you have Sat, Chit, Ananda, or for that matter, the good, the true, and the beautiful, these are three aspects of transcendence that are there. So especially Radharani is the personification of this Ladini, or pleasure-giving potency.
And the gopis
Many of the gopis are expansions of Radharani. Again, all these things are explained here, and we don't have time to dwell on them. But just remember that these are all supposed to be exchanges of love in spiritual bodies. It is said very clearly in Chaitanya Charitamrita later on in this chapter that what the gopis feel for Krishna is prema, which is love. Which has to be distinguished from kama, which is lust. And Krishnadas Kaviraj says that because you look at how the gopis behave, it looks like kama. But he says that love means to desire to satisfy the other without any reckoning of your own independent satisfaction. In other words, when there's love, when the other is satisfied, that's your satisfaction. Whereas lust is the idea to use the other for your own satisfaction. So what's in the spiritual world is actually prema, which is real love. And kama is a kind of curdled form of love that shows up in the material world and only goes by that name. But the original that all of us have is actually love for Krishna. But because of the covering of Maya, that love is now directed toward other objects. So this is what's going on. So Chaitanya came and took on, it says that the heart of Chaitanya, here this is text 106, is the image of Sri Radhika's emotions. In other words, Krishna, when they become one again, Krishna takes on the feelings of Radharani. And so this is now explained in this verse that the Lord has three desires. And that even though he did everything in Vrindavan, still there were three desires of him that left him unfulfilled, and so he needs to satisfy. As Chaitanya, he now goes further, and that's given in this introductory verse. So it says here, this is in the Sanskrit verse: desiring to understand the glory of Radharani's love, the wonderful qualities in him that she alone relishes through her love, and the happiness she feels when she realizes the sweetness of his love, the Supreme Lord Hari, richly endowed with her emotions, appeared from the womb of Srimati Sachi Devi as the moon appeared from the ocean. So now I'm going to just, this part I'll read, go a little faster. So Krishna is described here as having three urgent desires. The Sanskrit word is lobha, which means greed. And that he cannot fulfill so long as he remains in the position of the love object. In Vrindavan, he is the love object. The Sanskrit terminology is visha, vishaya. Even in his Brajalila, even though as exceptional as it is, he cannot fulfill these three further longings because he is the object of love. He can only satisfy these longings if he assumes the counterposition, that of the loving subject. The Sanskrit word is ashraya. The one who has the emotion is called the ashraya, the shelter or the abode of that emotion. And what elicits that feeling is the vishaya, the love object. Thus, he manifests himself as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this son of Sachidevi, to assume for himself the position and features of a devotee, Bhakta Rupa. Chaitanya is Krishna himself, he's called Krishna Swarup, with the luster, the beauty, and the emotions, the bhava of Radharani. And this way he can explore and enjoy for himself the further limits of prema bhakti, which only Radha herself has experienced. So here Krishna Das explains this. He says that Krishna, he describes Krishna's own amazement and wonder at Radha's love for him. He reflects, Krishna reflects, I am Satchidananda. I am the source of all rasas. Yet Radha's love has the power to overwhelm and control him. Moreover, however much pleasure he enjoys from her, Radha's enjoyment is always far greater. Her love abounds in contradictions. It is unlimited, yet constantly expands. It is momentous, yet devoid of any pride. It is spotlessly pure, yet always crooked and devious. This extraordinary love has its highest residence, its ashraya, in Radha, and it has Krishna as its sole object, Vishaya. Certainly, Krishna... Vishaya, I'm reading from my own text. I'm just summarizing now because it'll take too long. I'm summarizing now these last pages here. So Krishna enjoys all the pleasure entitled to him as her love's object. Nevertheless, Radha, the loving subject, feels a pleasure 10 million times greater. This is the number that's used here, 10 million times. Krishna's mind becomes curious and eager to taste that pleasure, yet limited by his position as the loved object, he remains baffled, and his desire increases more and more. And he wonders, what is the happiness that she experiences through her realization of my sweetness? So another, that's one thing, one question is, what is that happiness?
That's one, Boba.
Yeah, that's one. Mm-hmm. What is the happiness that she experiences through her realization of my sweetness? Then Krishna thinks about his own beauty. He thinks like this, my sweetness is wonderful, unlimited and full, and Radha alone always tastes, though through her love, all the nectar of that sweetness. Her love is as spotless as a mirror, yet its clarity always increases. My sweetness, similarly, has no scope to expand. Yet before the mirror, that mirror of her love, it shines with newer and newer beauty. And the constant competition between my sweetness and the mirror of Radha's love, neither it needs defeat, and both go on increasing constantly. When I see my own sweet beauty in a mirror, I desire to taste it myself. Yet I cannot do so. And when I ponder the meaning, I find my mind hankering after the condition of Radha. In this way, Krishna's sweet beauty irresistibly attracts everyone, even Krishna himself. When he cannot slack his thirst to taste it, his mind fills with anguish, and then he wonders, what is the extraordinary sweetness in me like that, that she alone is able to taste by her love? Now, that's the second thing. What is it about me that makes her love me so much? Then the third thing, the love seen in the gopis is exceptionally powerful and spotlessly pure, meaning without a tinge of selfish desire, comma, their love and its single-minded dedication to giving Krishna pleasure is so great that Krishna himself has confessed his inability to match it. He made a promise to give himself to his devotees as they give themselves to him. This is in the Bhagavad Gita. Yeyatam amkupajite tam satayata jamya. As they surrender to me, so I worship them. He said that. Yet in regard to the gopis, he admitted he could not keep it. The gopis have no interest at all in their own pleasure, and yet when they see that Krishna is pleased, they find themselves filled with a joy millions of times greater than his. This is because the happiness of the gopis resides wholly and solely in that of their beloved Krishna. At the same time, it is the joy of the gopis itself that gives Krishna great pleasure. Their joy increases their beauty. Through the reciprocation of love, the beauty and joy of both Krishna and the gopis increase everlastingly. The gopis are so intent on pleasing Krishna that they become angry at their own ecstasy if the symptoms of it interferes with their service. They want no benedictions, not even those of liberation, other than that service. Because the gopis know Krishna more intimately than anyone else, they are accomplished experts in pleasing him. They are his helpers, teachers, disciples, servants, friends, and consorts. Among all gopis, Radha is the best, surpassing the others in beauty, good qualities, good fortune, and most of all in love. She alone is the most beloved. In fact, the gopis' job is to assist Radha and Krishna in their mutual enjoyment. Without Radha, even they cannot please Krishna. Her love and joy thus surpasses Krishna's own, yet he longs to grasp it. So he wonders, what is the greatness of Sri Radha's love? In order to win the contest of love and bliss between himself and Radha, Krishna finds that he cannot do it from his own position as the object of devotion, and this impels him to assume her position as the devoted subject. Therefore, he himself becomes his own devotee, manifesting the person of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Thus, Chaitanya is the concretized form of Krishna's ultimate tribute to Radha, and actually to devotional service. As Chaitanya, Krishna enters into Radha's experiences and explores for himself the extremes of love known only to her. At the same time, he descends to teach the world bhakti by practicing it himself. Chaitanya is the one who most fully reveals Radha to the world and who teaches the method of serving Krishna perfected by Radha and her associates. So you see, within this love of Radha Krishna is a dynamic, and out of that dynamic, the divinity is always increasing. Krishna describes like this, that here's Radha and Krishna together, and Radha looks at Krishna and she sees how beautiful he is. And when she sees how beautiful he is, her joy increases. And because her joy increases, her beauty increases. Remember, these are people in spiritual bodies, right? There's no difference between the soul and the mind and the body and the soul. So when somebody's happy, they look better, but there's a limit to how far that goes with a material body that's different from the soul or from the mind. But in a spiritual body, when Radharani's happiness increases, her beauty her exterior features are the full manifestation of emotions. So her beauty increases. Then when Krishna sees that Radharani has become even more beautiful, his joy increases and his beauty therefore increases. And then Radharani, and so it goes, you see, without any limitation of ever increasing bliss. This is the dynamic that takes place. But then the other part of the dialectic is that at the same time Krishna is saying, I'm limited. But God has made me limited. In order to really overcome that limit, I have to become my own devotee. And from God's point of view, the lesson we derive from this, so many people want to be God. God wants to be a devotee. He thinks it's better. So this is his tribute to devotional service.
And so this is the theology behind Chaitanya. And then by propagating this Nam Sankirtan and giving a certain spiritual path to follow, the idea is also said there that this very elevated and high position can be taken by anybody that can understand Sanskrit, anything like that. It doesn't really matter. The name, the holy name itself, is so purifying. It gets rid of all dirty things in the heart, and gradually one can become qualified to experience this. Finally, I put on this short chapter called Chapter 9. But by the way, I skipped reading these parts. There are places you see in Radha's love for Krishna where the intensity of love reaches its height when what is called viraha bhakti, devotion in separation. The aim is for Krishna is to produce intensity of love. So when there's union, love is intense. But when there's separation, then it really becomes intense. And so it appears that Radharani, in times of separation from Krishna, literally goes insane. And it looks just like suffering. In fact, it is a form of suffering. But because it's a spiritual emotion, because love of God is greater, it's really the highest bliss. So here's one aspect. Krishna also suffers the same way in separation from Radharani. Especially as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there's descriptions in Chaitanya Charitamrita of his up all night in the madness of separation, banging his head against the wall, blood coming out everywhere, and stuff like that. You see it there also. Another chapter I added, the ninth chapter, this depicts Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a gardener. It's allegorical in the sense that he's planted the seed of love of God, and there's this tree that's growing up, which is called the desire tree of devotional service. There's this thing called a kalpa vriksha, a tree that gives you any fruit you want. It supposedly grows in the heavenly planets and in Vrindavan, where the fruit of this tree is love of God. This kalpa vriksha. So Mahaprabhu is depicted here of saying that he's both the tree. Well, he's described here as being both the tree. Krishna says, "I take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is himself the tree of transcendental love of Krishna, its gardener, and also the bestower and enjoyer of its fruits." Lord Chaitanya thought, "My name is Vishwambar, one who maintains the entire universe. Its meaning will be actualized if I can fill the whole universe with love of Godhead." Thinking in this way, he accepted the duty of a planter and began to grow a garden in Navadvip, the place he appeared. Thus the Lord brought the desire tree of devotional service to this earth and became its gardener. He sowed the seed and sprinkled upon it the water of his will. So he describes this tree as the different branches of Chaitanya's associates. And it's like a fig tree, because in a fig tree the fruits grow all over the trunk and everywhere. So it's like that, like a fig tree. He describes it as a fig tree. Now I'm in text, page 25, text 27.
Since Sri, 26, since Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was the original trunk, the taste of the fruit that grew on the branches and sub-branches surpassed the taste of nectar. The fruit ripened and became sweet and nectarian. The gardener, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, distributed them without asking any price. All the wealth in the three worlds cannot equal the value of one such nectarian fruit of devotional service. Not considering who asked for it and who did not, nor who was fit and who was unfit to receive it, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu distributed the fruit of devotional service. The transcendental gardener, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, distributed handful after handful of fruit in all directions, and when the poor, hungry people ate the fruit, the gardener smiled with great pleasure. And then he addresses this tree here. And he wants to see that this tree spreads all over the world. But then he has anxiety. I am the only gardener. How many places can I go? How much fruit can I pick and distribute? It would certainly be a very laborious task to pick the fruit and distribute it alone, and still I suspect that some would receive it and others would not. Therefore, I order everyone within this universe to accept this Krishna consciousness movement and distribute it everywhere. I am the only gardener. If I do not distribute all this fruit, what shall I do with them? How much fruit can I alone eat? And so on. So this depicts Mahaprabhu as in great anxiety. The Lord is in anxiety for the welfare of the people in this world. This does not seem like it's a pretend emotion. It seems like there's real anxiety in divinity, which maybe cannot be expressed in certain ways, but through Mahaprabhu can be expressed in this particular form. And so here we see this also. Okay, that's it.
Krishna's descent comes at a very, very sad time of history, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right.
Things in the balance.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, reading Mahabharata, the worst was yet to come.
Yeah, that's right.
But why would God decide to take this descent, this Chaitanya, at this point?
Well, because Krishna comes in Dwapara Yuga, he comes in Kali Yuga. So here we have to say it's the worst of times, but it's the best of times. Kali Yuga is normally not a good time for your spiritual advancement, but very paradoxically, he comes, I guess, when people are the most needy. And it says that the method that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gives is very powerful, more powerful, because in the 11th canto where it's discussing the Yuga Dharmas, and several other scriptures, it says whatever was achieved in the Satya Yuga by meditation, which was the Yuga Dharma for that age, yoga meditation, dhyana, what was achieved in the Treta Yuga by sacrifice, in the Dwapara Yuga by elaborate temple worship, can be achieved in the Kali Yuga by simply chanting the names of the Lord. So it says it's as good normally as that, but simply because people are not capable anymore of doing these things because of the deteriorating qualities of Kali Yuga. So somewhere in Chaitanya Charitamrita there's a text that says it's an ocean of faults, but there's one good thing, that Mahaprabhu has appeared during this time. Other Kali Yugas, he doesn't appear. It's tough luck. I guess you can say.
So I've got a couple questions, but I'm just wondering if I should are the 15 helpers maybe?
They're getting set up now.
Yeah, but how much longer should we discuss before we let them do their thing?
I think they're going to get it set and then go and leave it. When you get started, I think two things one. So where do we go?
Well, I guess you get a response that things are now even worse.
Yeah, that's right.
That,
Jesus didn't come at a great time either, did he?
Well, yeah.
In other words, he became one of these marginalized people.
Yeah, that's right.
Who had been at least conquered twice in recent centuries by the time they were there. And that marginalized people came among people who had status, easily pushed around by the powers of people, and assumed that role, incarnated among the poor, emphasizes something in the message. Mm-hmm. So I was just sort of trying to see, not trying to be too triumphalistic here.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're beginning to get a response. Things are so bad that Krishna's descending as a devotee, the one who chants, as a kind of way of showing the rest of us that as messy as everything is, God is there and the chances.
That's right. Well, there's a few of the points made about Chaitanya that you know, in former times as Ramchandra, or even as Krishna and Dwarka, he comes as a royal order, which have a license to kill, and so those who are demonic, he engages them in battle or combat, and he kills them. In Kali Yuga, if Krishna killed the demons, there'd be nobody left to save because everybody is demonic. And so his weapon is the more subtle weapon of the mantra, which goes inside and kills the demonic tendencies in the heart while sparing the life of the individual. It's a subtler weapon, in a way, and a more powerful weapon by the same time. That's another thing that's said about. Generally, when the Lord says there's trouble, the Bhagavatam tells kind of this cosmic history of perpetual warfare going on between the asuras and the asuras, the godly and the ungodly, or the devatas and the anti-gods. The big cosmic battles, Star Wars and stuff like that. And usually in the context of those things, when the devotees are running into problems, Krishna appears. So it is said that just as out of the friction of two pieces of wood rubbed together, fire comes out, so when there's strife between the devotees and the godly and the ungodly, that's when God appears and helps the devotees.
I'm not sure if I'm the amateur here, I'm not sure I completely understood, I have gotten the impression before that there were different types of incarnations.
Yeah.
We're talking about that. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he incarnates from time to time. I'm always, as a non-specialist, read that and seem like two different things. One would seem to be a sort of periodic, and then the other seemed to be a when things are falling apart, when the English kind of thing and the principles of religion have come to destroy evil and reestablish the good.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, was one of the things that in my early dialogue with devotees, suddenly I'm like, Jesus. Oh, okay. So it kind of made some sense. So, am I correct that there's two different sort of cycles going on there, sort of periodic? And
no. Well, things fall apart on a regularly scheduled basis, almost. There's planned obsolescence. You just have to maintain things by a certain. This is the Vishnu, the maintainer. So some of it, at the same time, it's also the stress that God is not bound by any schedule. This is just the general pattern. And he can come exceptionally for different reasons.
I'm thinking that the center of Chaitanya is sort of different from, let's say, Rama. It's different from the Krishna and the Mahabharata.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's almost a third reason.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, he's doing the same thing, but now sometimes in Kali Yuga, sometimes the Lord is called Tri Yuga. He appears in three ages. Other places it says four, and the explanation is that in Kali Yuga he does not come as God. He comes as a devotee, and so he's covered or hidden from sight a little bit.
And I know the focus is on Chaitanya, but this is just for my own understanding. I've seen In the pictures of the list of the avatars, the Buddha is mentioned as an avatar.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a dasha
avatar. Yeah.
That's a dasha, which is
ten.
Which is ten. I mean, there's so many, but somebody, Jayadev Goswami, wrote a famous song glorifying these ten.
Okay. So that's just.
Buddha is nine, is that?
Yeah, he's nine. Then there's Kalki. Then there's Kalki avatar. Yeah.
Okay.
I remember Jayadeva claims that the Quranic account of the Buddha makes it much more. because in some of the Puranas, it's the way that the asuras are defeated by the Buddha telling them, again, power by practicing austerities and practicing daily sacrifices. The paradox of the virtuous asura.
Mm-hmm.
And so the avatar of Buddha is to persuade them to abandon the way of the Buddha, of the Veda,
mm-hmm.
give up the Vedic practice, and so they lose their power, which is true. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. when you have any big demons, they can take it over the world, mm-hmm. since the Buddha came.
Mm-hmm.
But Jayadeva says, you know, to preach compassion, mm-hmm. to abolish animal sacrifices, mm-hmm. rather than mm-hmm.
I don't know if there are exact parallels, it just sort of inspired me to go back and take a look at things. And I was just jotting down things like that. Augustine's theology of the Trinity is the Father loves the Son in the beginning, the Son loves the Father back, and the bond is the Holy Spirit. So so the love.
Yeah, that's the one thing I'm more familiar with as far as Trinitarian theology goes in Augustine, I had a course.
But then I was thinking of the Song of Songs, so you have that sort of internal love of God. Then you have the Song of Songs, which is love between God and the soul, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was making note of these. Bonaventure has a work called Meditations on the Tree of Life. Talks about the fruits of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in the book of Revelation, there's 12 times a year, but for him, it's various graces in the life of Christ. Mm-hmm. There's little things that triggered off in me. I think one of them, is always fascinating, and you mentioned the fact that chanting the holy names is purifying in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember the story of, I believe it was Haridasa Thakura, who was in the day chanting, and the magistrate hired a prostitute to seduce him.
Mm-hmm.
By the simple listening to him chant, she was purified.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he gives her the cave and moves on.
That's right. Yeah, she says, okay, you know. He says, yeah. He says, I'll do what you want, but let me finish my rounds. She was up all night.
Buddha Montfort tells a story that always reminds me of that. In his book, The Secret of the Rosary, there was this convent of people, of nuns living very lax lives, except one chants the rosary every night. And so the priest has this vision, tells them you don't have to reform, all you have to do is promise to say the rosary. So they say, okay. And then within the year, they actually reform. And so that the whole idea of it, very good understandings, but William Munford talks about the angelic salutation, these are the words that God used to mean. The Holy Spirit always is attracted to these words. It just reminded me. I didn't know if you
had... Yeah, well, there's a whole theology, about the Holy Name, that it's based on the idea that the name Krishna and the person Krishna are the same. So that when you say the name of God, it doesn't have to be Krishna either, any name of God, this name of God, God is actually present. And in fact, it's an avatar of Krishna in the form of the Lord in the form of sound. So that by chanting the name of God, one associates with God. And if one especially takes the effort to chant with some attention and care, then the potencies that are the spiritual potencies that are within God go to work.
I refer to it as a sacrament in sacrament form, which is what it says. And in fact, some of the parallels, if you eat and drink without recognizing the body, so it's also if you eat and drink condemnation yourself. And I remember images that were used of drinking poison, at the name of God to when drunk by a serpent, becomes poisonous.
Become poisonous.
I wanted to add one thing is you mentioned the increased mutual love, which is really increasing. And there is at least one version of seeing the crucified Christ as the object of love. And there's a passage in Lady Julian where she's already begun with her devotion of her love, and Christ appears to her, wounded with the blood dripping. And he says, I did all of this because I love you, and if there's anything more I could have suffered because of the love for you, I would. And she looks at that and her love then. So showing yourself as love, as in this case, the portrait form is actually, but this is not seen as repulsive. This is seen as the lover suffering the ultimate. God can appear as beautiful even in one of
Yeah, that's interesting. The idea of internal reciprocation of the divine life going on that leads to ever increasing. The other thing is, you see, is that the jivas who become fulfilled make a real contribution to that. I mean, it's not that God is lacking. He's always purna. He's always full and complete. But still, he can still increase. There's just no upper limit. So there's actually a real contribution to the divine life that one participates in.
Is that similar at all? I've not really read a whole lot of the process, but I've gotten the impression that there's a sort of, every time we take a step forward, God increases.
Well, it is, but I was thinking of not that so much, which is a kind of limited, seeing God is limited and then increasing. But the problem we have with this concept of infinity is that up until the 1950s, it was thought of as only one. But now that we know there are levels of some infinities are bigger than others.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can say that God is infinite in its perfection, and yet
he can still increase.
He can still increase. I mean, there's no paradox there.
You see that back here, but Cantor, figured it out with transfinite sets. You know how it works? I mean, I had it explained to me by a mathematician.
Go ahead.
Do you understand?
Well, I'm assuming it's something like, I think geometrically, but like an infinite number of points in a line segment, an infinite number of points in a whole line, is something like
that? Well, this is a better story.
Okay.
Say there's a hotel with infinite rooms.
Yeah.
And each room is occupied, it's full. You can still add more guests. One guest comes, the bellhop blows the whistle. The person from room one goes to room two, the person from room two to room three, and so on, and the guy moves in.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine 10 guys coming. You could do the same thing. And then finally, an infinite number. So even though it's full, you can always add more. And also, even though it's full, you can take away all of it. And it'll still be full.
The simplest thing is the line is the sequence of numbers is infinite. There is no higher entity. But if you have a line segment and you put an integer, a pair of an integer with every point on the line, there are still more points left over because between any two points,
there's still room. Yeah.
So the number of points on a line is infinite. The number of integers is infinite. If the number of points on a line is a figure of infinity, balanced up won't rather than
that's right.
In the hotel metaphor, it would be if you have an infinite number of rooms and you can put a guest in each room, but then if you were to envision an infinite number of individuals in each room, and then say that there's an infinite number of rooms, so you have a larger infinity.
This is a bigger infinity.
Yeah, you have
a larger infinity. Right.
Frank
mm-hmm.
James is not this question yet.
I'm not sure we have to have all the discussion right now. But you can come into these fairly briefly. Anusma said at the beginning today that we should be looking not only at similarities between our traditions but also differences. And I'd like to ask two questions relating to possible differences, but maybe similarities. In your tradition, would Chaitanya as an incarnation of Krishna be spoken of the same way we speak of Jesus Christ as fully human and fully divine? That's my question. Second question. You see here speaks of jivas as spiritual sparks, some of which fall into the material world.
Mm-hmm.
Does that, in your tradition, mean that each of us has a jiva animating us, sort of like the way the Western idea of soul animating person?
Yeah, well, let me answer the second one first. Strictly speaking, we are the jiva. I mean, the word is Atma, Jivatma. Atma means self. And the self is really the soul, which is right now in our material embodiment, the presence of the soul is known by consciousness. But right now, we have a false idea of ourselves, and we've identified the self with the body and the mind, which according to the Vedantic flow, we're not that. The first thing is aham brahmasmi, I am spirit, I am Brahman, and therefore I'm not matter.
It's not the animator of the body.
Yes, not the animator, but it is the self. It animates the body, but the body is really not the self at all. And the coming, at least according to our own, that also the jiva has tiny samples of God. As God has unlimited freedom, we have minuscule freedom. And it is the misuse of that freedom, a choice to turn away from God, which is our choice, is not God's choice. We make it. It's attributable to us. It's a genuine act of free will that we come into the material world and we go back when we turn back again. And so we're responsible for that kind of thing. Now, as the first one, well, what do you think? He takes on. First of all, we can't say.
I think there is a difference.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out exactly how to say what that difference is. When he becomes a devotee, he certainly takes on the feelings and emotions of a devotee, and thinks of himself as subordinate, and by his yoga maya potency, kind of fools even himself. But it's certainly his tribute to the position of a devotee. And it certainly brings God and the devotee together in a really unique way. But does he become, you know...
Yeah, I think it's self-centered. So in other words, in that sense, it would be very similar.
Can you translate that?
I'm sorry?
Can you translate that?
Oh, okay. In the sense of
not really human,
apparently human.
Right. Yeah, that's right. It's more like
that's
a,
really yeah, where the
I don't take that out as you presented it. It didn't seem like he was taking the appearance of humanity.
What do you mean by appearance of humanity?
Well, it means he's not really human. That God is not really experiencing the thing that humans experience. And that is affected by the experience.
Yeah. I sometimes think about Star Trek, the original. We're definitely speaking words sort of, they appear at the end always, you know, they're sort of shimmering. They speak in about, they have three voices overlay, you know. This is not really our form. We have assumed it because it's one you will understand. And of course, I'm thinking like, I don't understand you right now. But but that would be Josephism, as I understand it, that Jesus just sort of appears to be human. His body's not real. It's not real. I don't think they have a notion of...
A Mahayana Buddhist once said to me, you Christians went wrong by rejecting Josephism. I don't think you want to be in that camp.
No, that's true. No, okay. That's what you mean by it's not true.
Josephism is what we were talking about, that you're...
Seeing human, like a false faith. Jesus' false faith.
But in Hinduism or Buddhism, there's a different understanding of being human.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, Purushottam Goswami, whenever he talks to foreigners, the first point he starts off with is, who are you? And the right answer to that question is, I'm not my body.
That's right.
And once I'm soul. But once you say that, there's a redefinition of being human. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the word became flesh. Mm-hmm. And I think therefore that there is a real difference.
Yeah, that's
well, besides, Atman is divine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there isn't a human divine difference that sticks.
The Atman is divine, but it's not divine the way that God is divine.
Well, see, but this is very tricky. You started off in the very beginning by saying that from God's point of view, physical and spiritual
are the same.
So the point is that, so are we talking about from his point of view, but from our point of view, it is human, he's in a fleshly body, you know, is this God new flesh again? It's another form of God new flesh.
Yeah, when he appears in a body, it's just never considered a material body.
Right.
It's considered a spiritual body.
Well, what does that mean?
Even though it looks like...
You just said his head on the wall.
Yeah, that's right.
So what's happening?
Even Krishna, you know, Krishna is pierced by the arrows Bhima. And he experiences them like love bites, but... but he's bleeding, you know.
So the Palaticists would say that Jesus is bleeding too on the cross.
Yeah.
They would say he's bleeding.
Yeah, he would say he's bleeding. It seems all apparent.
Mm-hmm.
That he's a real person, but he wasn't really a human.
Yeah,
well, God wasn't bleeding.
No, God wasn't bleeding.
So what form
is this thing?
Whereas some would say God was bleeding.
You see, I get the impression that the Josephists, it's kind of like if I were to dress up like the King of England, and I'm not really the King of England, but I've got the garments on. And so anything that you see happening to me is really you're just seeing the garments moving and everything. But, you know, I basically take off that robe and put it aside, you know, and go back to being me after I've done it. And with that's one of the things, like with runners, it says, you know, the risen Christ would have a different relationship, the Lord has a different relationship with the body, but not a looser one. So, you know, that the idea is he didn't check, at least in the Christian nation, he didn't check his humanity, whatever means resurrected body. We don't even know. Okay? We don't even have any idea what that means. But whatever it is.
Like under this is the...
He didn't check it at the door, you know.
Well, see, the resurrected body is very interesting because I think the Gaudiya Vaishnava would say Sri Chaitanya is his body.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
In our condition, we, as Jerry just said, we are not this body.
Yeah.
So,
and that's one area of dialogue I think would be interesting is I picked up from various Hindu philosophies that there's these ideas of layers of body.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So, you know, is that anything like what is meant by resurrected body? But on the other hand, in the Christian tradition, it has, you know, I don't think we need to think literally that this flesh comes back to life. That's, there's all sorts of problems with that, with the wounds from and everything else. But somehow what that resurrected body is has something to do with it.
Yeah, but see, like the idea.
So there's a transformation, almost a.
Yeah, the idea in Vaishnavism, or at least Gaudiya Vaishnavism, is something like this. So I have an identity as a devotee. And my identity as a devotee, I am a full-on person, but a full-on person devoted to Krishna. Now, right now, I'm practicing devotional service in this material body, which I took for nefarious purposes. But because it's a human body, I can use it for good. Now, this is called a sadhika deha, the body of a practicing devotee. But if I become pure, the soul, which the soul being a person, is actually fully endowed with senses. Now these senses have been manifested materially in this way, and so if I practice pure devotional service, the soul, which Ramanujacharya describes it as a body soul being compacted, you know, it's compacted. It unfolds, and I discover who I am. I discover in relationship, as I love Krishna in a certain way, my spiritual form becomes manifest as a gopi, as a cowherd, you know, and to exchange in loving service to Krishna. I don't know who I am until I start to see who God is in relationship to me, and then I discover myself. So The idea in Gaudiya Vaishnavism is that a very advanced devotee has got not only a sadhaka deha, the practice is here, but a siddha deha. And then when this body goes, you know, the siddha deha goes on.
Yeah.
In fact, it's already in the spiritual world.
It actually says in the Bhagavad that the devotee, actually, the body transforms. You get in some sense a new devotional body while in this body. So
you mean this one here?
Yeah, so this body actually takes on a new status by virtue of the fact that there's a devotional body that's
inside. Yeah, well you know, it's compared to a gold-plated box. The material body, the gross material body of a pure devotee, is compared to a gold-plated box. Prabhupada uses this example. In other words, for all practical purposes, in other words, if one is on a fully pure platform, there are no impediments or inconveniences to spiritual life experienced by this material body.
Is that a solid gold box then?
Solid gold box means the siddhadeya.
Okay.
Gold-plated box means for all practical purposes, it'll still grow old, eventually it'll drop off, but you know, that's not a disturbance to spiritual activities.
People who practice gopi bhava, their bodies actually change. They become more feminine in their physical body.
I'm not so sure about that.
They look that way.
Well,
their whole behavior
is
similar
to that tradition.
Well, it's it's to practice them in this case. It's the devotion which expresses itself in a committed practice, which in a gopi sense, being as the beloved or lover of Krishna, they take on
this. This is changing on what you just said, because I think that, yes, there's a lot of Christian
psychologically, yeah, but the ghost body changes so much in our mind.
No, but when you were talking about this anthropology, I was thinking, yeah, the bondage, you know, says that typically that's what we really are, except that even we've married to this Francis, but tangible thing. Yeah. So, I mean, it's in Bonaventure, that kind of anthropology. These kind of archetypal thing that, you know, that we truly exist in God archetypically. The one archetype is Christ, from which everything comes, and that's who we really are. But we're embodied beings, and as God became embodied. And so, you know.
So, John, do Catholics, by and large, accept the stigmata as a gift?
Well, they would see St. Francis as a gift. They're not sure about anyone else.
Well, I think the Orthodox question out there is the same way. That, you know, there are maybe a few select people who could actually do that and get away with it, or be revered for it, but by and large, that's considered a kind of cheapening of the faith.
It's not even desirable.
No,
it's not even desirable.
No,
the stigma is not exactly something that you can surround and aspire to, you know.
But there's even a tradition in our church of the incorruptible, so people who, because they're so close, that they almost, their body is almost
their
body, and they lie there. And they never decay.
Yeah, that's right. They're the same thing.
Yeah.
And who it is who lay in his own stool and urine, but it made the countryside fragrant. The commentary is that don't imitate this unless your stool also smells like a little perfume.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Then
the
Light. Francis glowed too, so he put on the implant.
What would you say?
What amazes me in recent years when we get into the technical terms that you want to use in your own scholasticism, it's quite complicated.
Yes, it is.
It's really
complicated. Because people are like working on it all the time.
That's the whole point of scholastic tradition.
But what amazing thing.
I had somebody one time say in an email address, they said, well, I no longer practice in the Christian tradition, I practice Vedanta, they said. And I said, oh, have you read, you know? And then they said, well, no. Well, I said, have you ever read Thomas Frank's? They said it was too hard. I said, then you have never read.
Yes, you want to try hard, try junker.
Well, there's hardness for familiarity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But there's complexity in terms of all the technical
things. Yeah, you should see it. I mean, it's amazing if you look at Rupa Goswami. You know, here's people like can completely experience overwhelming ecstasies. I believe they do that. And then can sit down and like write this aesthetic, you know, analysis of these ecstasies, all kinds of technical terms and details. I mean, they borrowed it from aesthetic theory. It's already there. But it's transformed too. But it's amazing that you have that kind of double capacity.
Well, in the subject matter, it's meant to be something rather simple. It's love of God.
That's right.
And then you want to
ho, simple.
anyone,
that's right.
Anyone, the majority of whom are non-scholastic, can experience.
When Bonaventure was dying, somebody said to him, well, can a peasant woman experience God to the depth? I mean, somebody didn't even care for Bonaventure to the extent that you do. And he said, well, certainly. The person supposedly ran outside and yelled, did you hear that, peasant woman? Even the great Bonaventure says that you may have a greater experience in God than he does.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't depend on any of those things, scholasticism or intellectual ability or anything like that. But somehow you have to do it. If you
that brings it back to, John, your original question of Chaitanya, why does he appear? Because that's precisely the point, that it's something simple. And it's
available
a simple
to all. Right?
Yeah, and the whole idea is that by the very fact that the fact that he appears in the worst possible time is simply highlights the fact that highlights his generosity, that he's giving what is the highest gift in a time that's the least eligible for it. So it's inverting the whole thing, and therefore his own saviorship and his compassion and generosity is highlighted by that something. So, and this is why Chaitanya is often shown in a pose standing with one hand raised and one hand below, the idea being that he's pointing to the highest thing.
That's
and saying,
whirling dervishes do that.
Yeah.
Dervishes.
And giving what's low.
What's it called?
The whirling dervishes.
Yeah, well, what kind of stance?
Sufi
stance. Oh, yeah. Sufi stance.
When they do the
So am I to understand that one of the discussions at some point is going to be what happens when the Lord incarnates as a theologian?
Everybody has a theologian.
And he's quite a theologian.
Oh, without doubt.
But Ravi, the thing goes for the whole Bhakti movement, for the Bhakti Renaissance. I mean, Ramanuja was famous for, you know, shouting out his mantra to everyone on the street.
The point is that wouldn't work if it weren't the worst age. You know, if it weren't the fact that it happened at this time is extremely important.
Right. But it's not, what I'm saying, it's not totally unique to Chaitanya. He sort of accentuates that even more, I think. But it really begins with Ramana.
But the worst stage you're talking about is a general human tradition.
Yeah,
that's
really
boils
down to that.
And we're talking about people.
We're talking about what?
A people who have been blessed and were in truly tragic times.
Mm-hmm.
And he became one of these among the tragic people.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about the Hebrews, right?
But wasn't that your earlier point, that Chaitanya is not the Kshatriya, he's not?
No, he's come from a Brahmana family, but at that time, you know, things were rough also. There was also a foreign imperial occupation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, there you go.
No, but you should. It's amazing to me that Chaitanya Charitamrita is really, there's no animosity at all.
No, it's actually quite.
It's like amazingly. They tell all kinds of atrocity stories, but it's just completely neutral. There's no persiflage, there's no diatribe.
Chaitanya in the context of Muslim dominated
theory. Somebody must have.
Yeah, there's been studies done by Joseph O'Connell, who used to teach at University of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been done as deeply as could be, but he's made head starts on it, on talking about the Chaitanya Vaishnava movement in the context of Muslim Bengal, and especially on how their self-identity in relation to how they saw themselves in relation to the other, namely the main other there being the Muslims, and how, for example, they use the term Hindu.
Hindu, yeah, then it shows up in the text. Yeah.
It's only used in reference when they're trying to contrast themselves
to the Muslims.
Yeah.
Right.
A non-Muslim.
Hindu, that's what the basis of Hindu means, a non-Muslim.
Yeah.
And Bengal was under the domination
of
the Delhi Sultanate, or was it?
There's a
Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's association in Puri with the King Prataparudra. There's this theory by some Indian scholars that Prataparudra's kingdom could have held up a lot longer had he not associated with Chaitanya.
got distracted.
You know, just like all that fun and chanting in the streets just kind of weakened, made it more susceptible to Muslim rule later on. So there are arguments back and forth.
I have a question for later along that.
Yeah.
No, just
I thought the bhakti movement nationally grew in response to Muslim occupation.
I think it did, but it also suffered from it.
Yeah, true. But I'm saying it wasn't only Chaitanya.
No, no.
Similar bhakti leaders elsewhere.
The South never. I mean, Aurangzeb, I understand, went down to the South. He kind of freaked out a little bit.
Yeah. Bhakti had burned
there. It didn't get anywhere in the South. You had more luck.
But
yeah,
I
military.
Yeah, right.
I think there's a difference there, though, in terms of what you were saying earlier, that there's a difference in the view of history, because although all this is happening, that context, there's not so much of a sense that God is trying to accomplish something through that context, that he's come to a specific people and that history is meant to prove something. Those people are there and that history is there. It's relevant, but the history itself is not fulfilling the purpose of God in the same way that it is.
Time, there's a sense of this is the true tradition that gives access to this knowledge of God,
right.
Experience of God, which is not able to be fruitful at this time because of.
This is especially reminding me, and it's causing me to reminisce because I think of Paul, you know, in Rome, you know, with all the Stoics, the Epicureans.
Athens, right. The unknown God, right. The Isle of Mars.
In Rome, the Judah.
Right.
But then I'm thinking also of the way Chaitanya took his tour down south, and, you know, he met up with the Buddhists, he met up with. So, I mean, you know, there's.
Tatravadis.
Right.
I agree, this notion of this God acting in history. Is very different.
Mm-hmm.
But there's more to the context than I think we're giving us.
Mm-hmm.
It really helps understand Chaitanya. It's just like, you know, oh, God, he's going there. He can be any place that has these ideas, you know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not.
Mm-hmm.
It's my understanding is that because of the Muslim influence, the Hindu community became very, very, very rigid. And concentrated on ritualistic purity very highly, and that Chaitanya in some ways broke this part of it down.
What do you mean by broke this part of it down?
Rejected it, you know. They began to emphasize caste, ritual purity. Broke it down. Yeah, you know, because Haridas Thakur, his you know, one of his right hand guys, was a Muslim.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
that was like pretty transgressive right there.
Jivan Rupa had.
The Jivan Rupa were worse in a way because they they were very highly educated, but they had been born in a Brahmin family. They were trained to be government servants. They learned Persian. They learned Urdu. I mean, they were like really
government servants under the Muslim,
government. Yeah. Yeah, they were ministers and stuff like that for Nawab Hussein Shah.
Mm-hmm. No, I keep thinking.
And then they joined him, you know. So they had, and those days. I mean, when you know, you're a Muslim or you lived with a Muslim, man, you were finished. It was all over.
And the Zelts, who, you know, were just all who seem to bring up the Jesus and stuff.
When you look at these two texts, you say, we're not going to get to this place.
Yeah.
You know, I think we ever should look at these two texts. I think it's the time when we put Krishna Lila up against the gopis with
the passion.
With the passionary, was it?
Yeah.
That's right.
That's right.
We have really tested Providence.
Yeah.
We're up against church.
Huh? Yeah, Rabindra. What's the overlap with Akbar and
the Goswamis and Aurangzeb?
He's 1550 to 1600.
Yeah. Akbar gave permission and funding for the building of Golden Devaki in the Vrindavan.
Yeah, that's right.
And so the
funding as well.
Yeah.
You know this picture you see in Vrindavan of showing Rupa Goswami, he's kind of kneeling down on one knee? That's from a big painting showing sadhus in Akbar's court.
Mm.
I don't know how they know it's Rupa Goswami.
The son of Vallabhacharya and their family got named Goswamis by Akbar.
Mm-hmm. Akbar was quite different.
But in Muslims' mind, Akbar is a Muslim who went bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And Aurangzeb straightened everything out, right?
I was given the name Akbar by a Sufi teacher. I just find this fascinating. Maybe that's all.
Well, this is what they are.
Yeah.
What did he say about Akbar?
The reason he gave me that name, he liked Akbar. But his thing was trying to unite the religion.
Yeah, well, that's another Sufi thing. They're also suspect.
Why they were different religions. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, will your life go along with that? And I said, my wife doesn't care how many wives I have. I have as many as I want. She just won't be one of them.
Well, he's a saint. How far is a saint in the Jesuit world?
Is that right?
Well, he invited him into the
They invited
world.
Him in, yeah.
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 Huh.
Did he live to regret it?
No, they thought they were going to convert his son, but his son led them on and didn't convert.
But he had one Christian wife.
At least one of them.
No, he was the devil. He was not one.
He had so many. More than one Mazda.
They were ready. It seemed to go when he wanted that. Would anyone like dinner or lunch?
Yes. Sounds like it, yeah.
It's not a mandatory part of the program.
Oh, it is.
You want to be very flexible.
And okay.
It's all day or later. That's great. 31.
Yeah, I did
it. Is it clearly written here what the three external reasons are? Well, I'm never clear.
External reasons?
Yeah.
There's two.
There's
the extra reasons were it's given in the verse.
We can just have a moment of silence before
that's mentioned. That's also mentioned as a reason, but it's not one of the chief. Well, the priest is devotee, so if you count that, with the verses there that describe the reasons.
All this left is just in the practice, or until he was in the
grave. Oh, right now? Okay.
Separation of borders.
Where you should grasp the fruit.
With eyes we gather your presence this evening, we ask your blessing upon us, upon all those with whom we live and whom we love. Bless in particular our food and those who prepared it so lovingly for us, and keep us grateful for all the other good things that we receive. We ask this in your holy name.
Amen.
Thank you. Let's enjoy.
Yes.
So this is the one that gives the external reasons. That chapter on the external reasons is a commentary on this verse. So his external reason appeared in the age of the Kali that he stole Ujjvala Rasa, the conjugal mellow, through his own service. Yeah. That's the main reason it's given in this verse. So when he talks about it here, the fourth verse here, this is the verse. Okay, here it is. So he said, I've not given the Lord loving service. I shall accept the role of devotee.
Okay.
And I shall teach devotional service by practicing myself. So that's.
Accept the role of devotee? And
yeah, in order to teach devotional service.
Teach devotional service?
Yeah, so he's giving devotional service by becoming the teacher. So accept the role of devotee is not the separate purpose.
Okay.
It's to teach by accepting the role of the body.
Okay, teach by. So two. And the third maybe is
what he's really teaching is how to get conjugal love. And then he comes also, and just that's not in the verse, but then at the end it says the principal reason.
Okay, so that is the
Yeah, that would be fine.
So that's one, two, and three.
You can break them up, yeah, if you want to, sure. All right. Yeah. Oh, Ron is so.